you don't exist without your partners, and your partners are your strongest, one of the strongest assets if you know how to utilize them.
Welcome to The Growth Show. What keeps us driving is what drives you further. This is your hosts, Sebastian Kunz and Sarah Kaya.
Hello everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of The Growth Show. We have the big pleasure to host Peder Risk this time in our episode number 20 of The Growth Show. He has some impressive steps in his, throughout his entire career, where we're going to take a closer look at during this conversation. One of the few stops that he made was KPMG. He worked for BNP Paribas. He is still a mentor for Techstars, and he is the CMO for Copious. And what that is, he's going to tell us all about it. Thank you so much for having me with there.
Thanks, guys.
So, Peder, just to kick it off, if you could connect the dots, growth and yourself, how would you describe it?
Yeah, figured. I think as we mentioned before in our like side chats, it's kind of a journey that you go through with your career, just like you go with your life. And I had the opportunity to start off by actually studying computer engineering, which was not mentioned earlier. So I was doing my PhD in robotics back in 2012 at Siemens Research Lab in Paderborn, where I started. And that was just an inspiration for working in like technological solutions that could potentially change the world and do something that is different and not easy to crack on. And then along the way, I was always fascinated about business and how could you apply these new technologies together. So like from studying computer science and from working in robotics until now leading the sales and marketing in a robotics startup with a CMO role, which is Copious, the dots in the middle are connected in the way of trying to understand business challenges and strategies and how could you apply like understanding of the market and the challenges around the existing industry. So like working at KPMG and consulting, you look at challenges that facing different companies and try to solve it for them. Working investment banking would be companies that are looking to solve their current problem or customer problem by acquiring other smaller, bigger companies. And then at the end is now working on building a product that solves a problem for the retail industry.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Cool. So tell us a bit about the last step that you've done. I mean, you from founding your own company in Egypt 7-8 years ago, which was construction and real estate, to becoming a CIO and CFO advisory at KPMG. How does that even work?
I really don't know. I'll tell you my perspective around it. But starting a real estate development agency, which was essentially what it was back then when I was still a student. I was studying computer science, like I said. It was again a market opportunity. I was back then in Egypt, in Cairo. So I was studying at the German University in Cairo, where at my age back then, everybody was getting engaged and trying to look for an apartment. So like my whole class was just looking, going out and talking about trying to find apartments. And I was resident back then in a new city called New Cairo, which is outside the capital. And I had access to see different apartments. So like whenever I drove from my home to the university, I see it's like all these signs of like people selling apartments with installments over the next 3-5 years. So what I essentially did was, while I was driving, then I would just take a day off and drive around the city, collect all these phone numbers from all the vacant apartments and call them up and try to get an appointment with them, see the apartments. And then I'll go back to the people I know, my friends or friends of friends. I say, hey, I know, like, what exactly are you looking for? And be like, I'm looking for a 2-bedroom apartment that is in this area. I'll be like, oh, I know actually 5 ones. Let me take you and show you these apartments. And I did that for 1.5 years. So like that was the starting point. The starting point was just collecting offline information about existing opportunities and having access to the people who wanted to buy them. But not everyone will just drive around and collect these information. So I was just lucky to find a problem that tried to solve and somehow finance my life around it.
That's awesome. How did that work out? The entire company was was alive for multiple years. So how was the acceptance?
Yeah. That kind of built up all my savings to immigrate from Cairo to Europe. I think I sold about 10 or 15 apartments back then. We're building like a very simple tracking tool, kind of automated in Excel, where once you drop in an apartment information, it shows up in a like a small platform. Like just it's not even a platform. I think it's wrong to call it a platform. It just shows up in an overview page on Excel, and we start like I had that database of close to 500 apartments or more.
Mm-hmm.
That then was kind of sold for like pennies to another company.
Mm-hmm. But then after you took all your savings, you went to Europe. How did you end up at KPMG?
I think before KPMG, like I said, I was working as a research assistant for mm-hmm. 2 years at Siemens Research Lab.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I came to Germany, I came with a vision to finish my PhD in computer science.
Yeah.
So I was developing, it was actually really interesting. We were trying to develop a solution that learns how human learning behavior is and apply it on robots. So if you want to put it in simple terms, you know, like when you have a dog, you cannot really tell the dog what the dog should do as an objective, which is, let's say, you throw the ball and the dog should run and get the ball. And what essentially happens is that the dog observes your behavior when they do a certain action. And when you give a reward to dogs, so like give them candy or the sweets that you give them, they try to maximize this. So the dog doesn't really care about the ball as much as they care about the affection that you give them, the reward that you give them afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And this is called reinforcement learning, which is you learn by reinforcing the same action over and over again. And the project I was working on, which was the first experiment in the world to do in real life, that you have a robot and a ball, and the robot will drive around 300 times, trying just like different random actions.
Mm-hmm.
And when the robot catches the ball, which is see that the ball is between their arm, they get a reward, which is like a one instead of getting a zero.
Mm-hmm.
And then the robot, like over time, starts to maximize what is the shortest path for them to get this one. And this one is getting the ball.
I guess you've had more crazy tests and experience in the past. Is there one where you thought that was like amazingly crazy, amazingly different?
I think back then, because the research lab working from Siemens was like, it was kind of an underground research lab. So it's like nothing like in the fancy TV when you watch like people working in robotics. It was literally a basement lab with tens of different robots and with different departments. And one department, the department I was at was called Intelligent Robotic Systems. And the department right next to me was called Emotional Robotic Systems. And that back then was in 2012, where you could see people working on how robots could mimic like human interactions and human emotions. So
mm-hmm.
like you would stand in front of a robot and you smile to it and the robot would smile back at you, or you'd be angry and the robot would be angry back at you. And like I said, like that was back in 2012, where it was not like people didn't talk about AI and robotics as much as they talk today about it.
Mm-hmm.
But so like it was the conversation that were happening all the time was actually, would robots be able to substitute humans, or would they be able to take human jobs? That was discussed back then. Yeah.
So what's your point of view on this?
I think it's really a philosophical question. So it's
yeah.
if you think about how cars replaced horses or how computers replaced so many jobs, in essence, if you ask anybody when was the last time you went to a bank, and they will always tell you, I actually don't remember. Or if you ask them, like, when was the last time you went to a bank to withdraw money,
mm-hmm.
and there is a teller, right? There's always a teller in the bank where you can ask for, hey, I want 500 euros, and you get it from your bank account. And this doesn't happen anymore, right? Like nobody ever thinks about going to a bank to get 100 euros. What you do is you just go to an ATM machine. So an ATM machine in a way is replaced a human job.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is not the challenge. I think, yes, robots will keep or technologies being developed today will continuously take people jobs. I think the question is, would there be jobs for humans to do in the future?
Yeah, very interesting topic, I believe.
You also were, like, still are, since 2016, venture strategy consultant. as well as mentor right now for Techsters as well. So curious, what would you say were like companies who did like horribly wrong where you helped them, or what was your best advice where you did see something coming out which was like amazing?
I don't know about best advice, but I think there's two things. One is your role as an advisor, which is kind of a knowledge transfer of things that you've seen before.
Yeah.
And then number two is you not being emotionally invested into the question you're trying to answer gives you a different perspective. So I don't think necessarily it's the best advice. I think all advices that any advisor would give to a founder or entrepreneur or any regular, like in any regular day-to-day challenges are most of the time known. It is the process to choose that this is the right advice or this is the right decision that really matters. And to put this into perspective, like there was one of the companies I consulted a few years ago where they were having a challenge on which strategic direction they should go to. And the business that they had back then, that's I think 3 years ago, it was an app development tool that using a platform. So like you don't need to have any coding and all of a sudden you have an app. The company started maybe 2010, 11, when everybody wanted to have a mobile app, you know, like every barbershop wanted to have a mobile app, every restaurant wanted to have a mobile app. And back then it was one, prestigious, two, it's a trend. Everybody was downloading apps, and now you know that nobody downloads apps anymore. And the question was what segment they could serve. And all the decisions that were being suggested was mostly based on intuition. So like one say, no, every baker or every coffee shop needs to have stamps for loyalty, and therefore they need to have their own app. So what we did is that we sat down, looked at, they had, I think, 100,000 customers back then, or 100,000 apps. So we looked at every single one of them, categorized them into different segments. So we said like, okay, small businesses, what are the small businesses? You have bars, restaurants, barbershops, flower shops, and then try to contact them and ask them what do they use the app for. And one of the things that they were very convinced about, like this whole loyalty thing, we called all the businesses that the main feature they wanted to use when they signed up for the platform was the loyalty, with the loyalty feature, and asked them why are they like, would there be something for them? The most of the reaction was that I'm sorry, I don't even remember signing up for this. I don't even use it. So I think, like I said, it's not necessarily the advice, but it is the process that you kind of show to someone that whenever you want to make a decision, then you want to think first about how, like you need to decide first how you want to make this decision.
So we talked about the mechanics, what makes a great advisor actually. What would you say makes a mentor a great one?
Great question. I think number one, 100% is humbleness, and not like that your internal belief that you don't know everything and you don't know better. Because like especially if you're doing mentorship for founders, it's people who have been working for 2-3 years or 1 to 3 years, you know, they've been sleeping on couches and not sleeping at all, and you cannot come and tell them, hey, your business is shit, let me tell you how to do it. Right.
Yeah.
Even if their business is shit, you just can't say, right? So I think especially if you want to mentor someone, that means that you have this internal feeling of you want to do knowledge transfer and kind of give back to community. And if you come from an egoistic or an arrogant position, then your message is not going to get across, and therefore your mentorship is worth nothing. You have to really believe that you could be wrong, and you really believe that you don't know better. And mostly, so I think it's number one. Number two is, instead of telling like this directive way of advising, I think what works better is asking the right questions, and then and not thinking that you know the answer, like not asking the questions so that you direct someone into a direction, but actually asking the right questions and then thinking through these questions together in order to get a fine answer.
Yeah.
At the end of asking the right questions, you also guide people, right?
Yes, but like I said, it's not about guiding people. I think it's also guiding yourself into the right direction. Because a lot of times you think that, you know, Uber should not come to London, or like, let's say Starbucks should not go to Italy because the Italians are very fond of their coffee. Mm-hmm. So you cannot go to Starbucks and ask them like, hey, do you think the Italians are very fond of their coffee? Because this is then a directive question to make them believe what you believe, which I don't think is the right way to put it. I think the right way would to actually ask the right questions so that you can both together come to that conclusion.
What would we say was so far one of the best questions in your catalog, which you can nearly use always to maybe understand one of the issues of her founder, you know?
Yeah, I don't think it's the best. I think it just, and I even asked you guys that question in the side chat before, which is why are you doing what you're doing?
Yeah.
And it is not necessarily for me to know. I think it's also an awareness question that you could be doing one thing, but for so many different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And based on the reasons why you're doing it can determine if you succeed or not. And if you're attracting the right customers or not.
Yeah. Cool. Bader, tell us about how you're bringing the future of AI into retail. Tell us about bringing robots to retail. What are you doing at Copios? And tell us about the role as a CMO and how did you start there?
Yeah, Copios, the company I'm working with right now, is what we do essentially is that we ensure that when customers come to the store or the client, like the shoppers come to the store, they have their best experience ever. And the best experience for shoppers is two things, is availability and findability. So availability is that the products you're looking for exist in the store, because otherwise you wouldn't go to a physical store anymore unless you have a need that you need to fulfill.
Yeah.
And then number two is findability, is enabling them to find the products they're looking for. And the way we do this, we use computer vision to locate and find all the products in the on the shelves. So the robot will drive inside the store, scan the shelves, and then identify when a product is missing or a product is misplaced or has the wrong pricing. And meanwhile, map that full store into a digital map. So create kind of a digital twin of the physical store and provide it as an indoor navigation for customers. So if you go to MediaMarkt store, for example, in Germany, you could use a map on your phone where you can write iPhone X, and you would know if the iPhone X exists in the store. And if it exists in the store, then it will show you what is the route for you to take in order to find this, the product you're looking for. My role is kind of a mixture between sales, marketing, partnership. So like all the commercial activities within the company started about 2 years ago, so right after Copios, after we raised seed round. And my objective was to commercialize the product. So the team has worked in developing the technology and developing the product layer. And then the goal was to find the right customers. Within the first year, we managed to have 10 retailers that we work with across Europe. That includes Lidl, Metro, MediaMarkt, Albert Heijn in the Netherlands, Carrefour in France, among others.
Awesome. Very, very cool. You didn't found the company, right? So you joined after the seed phase, you said?
Yeah, I joined after the seed phase.
And it's now a company of 22 people, according to LinkedIn.
Today we're about 35.
Ah, 35. So what's upcoming for you? What's happening in 2020?
We just got acquired.
Mm-hmm.
With depending on when is this opposite episode being released, but we just got acquired. So in the whole time of the company for over the past 4 years, one of the things that we got lucky with and did well was to hire the right people.
Yeah.
So we have a team, our team is about 30 engineers. A big portion of them are PhDs who developed potentially the best computer vision technology in the world in the retail space, as well as like our business traction by working with all the European, like we became the biggest European provider within only 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
So the company that acquired us is a larger, or potentially acquiring us depending on when this is being released.
December 31st.
they developed a similar solution, not as good from the technology perspective, and they don't have any presence in Europe. So it's a combination between getting better technology that they could use globally,
mm-hmm.
and having access to the European market, which they don't have.
Mm-hmm. How is the acceptance? Like, what have you felt being different than other countries? I mean, which countries do you operate right now?
Germany, France, Netherlands, and now the UK.
Have you felt some or noticed some significant differences between, let's say, the UK and France, or in general between all of those countries?
I think one is that everybody thinks they're the best, and they do things better. There's definitely language barrier in countries more than others.
Yeah.
So France being the least open for English conversations,
yeah,
compared to Germany and the Netherlands. I don't think any retailers, including like the large ones with very local headquarters, like Lidl, where they're located in Nikkelsrum, and Netto, which they're located in Max Hotel, like places that I've never heard about before. And everybody in the organization speaks English, especially from the management side. Same for in the Netherlands. The UK, they do business differently, and they always look at Europe as it's outside, hence the Brexit. But in terms of operation, they all come from each other companies. So they kind of, the playbook is kind of mixed in a way. Lidl exists in the UK. VPs and business leaders from Lidl worked at Tesco or vice versa.
Yeah,
so it's, I don't think it's as different as in the past from the stories I hear about the past.
Mm. Since you joined like Copious as CMO in January 2018, what was the biggest growth strategy you've seen, or what was maybe different when other people did, which went really well, or maybe even impressed you that it went even well?
Like, I think we really hustled so hard, and like to strange extent, like to get in touch with Walmart in the US, I had to pretend that I was master's students in computer science doing a similar project like the one I'm doing, like what we're doing at Copious, but just doing it from an academic way. Broke into their hiring. They had like a tech hiring event. Went there, pretended I was a student, wanted to talk to somebody who works in this project, got the right name, got the right email address, got the email address of the head of engineering because they thought that would be useful for hiring, and then go back and then write them an email from my Copious account. So like, I think we went above and beyond to get in touch, especially because none of us have retail experience. We don't, especially in the beginning of an early stage company, you can't afford hiring someone who has 20 years experience at SAP or 20 years experience at Oracle. So you rely on young, smart, motivated people to do things. So this is one example of how what you need to do to, in order to get to your client in a way.
Mm-hmm.
What we did also, something we called Octopus Strategy. I think that was a very interesting experience to see how it works, which is try to be everywhere for your potential lead customer. And that is sending emails to everybody in the organization. Meanwhile, going to hang out where they hang out. So like, look at all the innovation events that you go to and just be there and be on stage. And like that they say, like at some point they'd be like, you're everywhere. And you'd be like, yes, we're everywhere. can we have a conversation? Yeah.
Well, to be fair, you were at some point student and you were at some point studying computer science.
Sure.
So
exactly. I didn't lie.
You didn't lie.
Timeline perspective.
Well, probably the time was not exactly the time.
Maybe 6-7 years in between.
Yes, probably.
Yeah.
So curious, what would you say for people who are also like doing some robotic stuff or similar, what would you say would be a great distribution channel to start with? Any app channels or any other different stuff people should maybe try or even maybe could copy from Copious?
I think what helps us a lot is that we spoke innovation as in our deepest interest. When we started to think about, okay, like who in the organization will buy? And we spent a few months trying to think about like who's gonna buy this, like who should we talk to?
Mm-hmm.
And what we quickly realized is that, well, if you're building a completely new product that doesn't exist in the market, then your channel is not the user of the product, because the user of the product doesn't have a budget to buy it. And on the other hand, there is this now new trend that every organization is hiring an innovation manager and innovation team and trying to activate relationships with accelerators so that you can have access to new startups and new trends. Mm-hmm. So what we did is that we just doubled down on this. We joined 10 accelerators and we always made sure that we don't give equity, or at least not much equity. Mm-hmm. We joined 10 accelerators. We spoke to all the innovation. So we stopped looking at the person who used it, the person who's going to buy it in 2 years from today. Mm-hmm. And we tried to look at the person who's going to try it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think this is, that speeded a lot of things. On the other hand, it's also really tricky. I read once before, or I'm not sure if I made this up, but and what we said is that like pilots are the graveyard of tech startups.
Mm-hmm.
Because especially if you have a very innovative and sexy product that makes everybody wants to try it, you know, like everybody wants to go home and go to their friends and say, hey, I have I just got a robot in our company and I'm testing a robot and take a picture with the robot and show it to their cousin and kids. And so like there is this like line where you need to understand when to pull out of such situations and not die because of like investing all your resources into pilots.
So of course we watched the video of the shelf scaling robot. In the video it says Copious Mitra Labs. What is Mitra Labs?
Mitra Labs is one of our very strong partners who provide the hardware. Maybe it's a strategy or maybe it's also like, but what we thought about early on is that, well, especially with a small team, you cannot really build everything.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought a lot about what's our competitive advantage, and we thought that our competitive advantage in the long term for any tech startup would be the ecosystem that you build around yourself, rather than the product or the technology. Because if you get 10 strong computer engineers, they could build any product that exists today, you know, or at least some functionalities of it. And we thought is that it's the ecosystem. So what we did is that Mitra Labs is a hardware partner that they provide us with the robots. We have different hardware partners that provide us with cameras. We work with Panasonic, with Intel, with Toshiba. Sorry that the question took a little bit longer to answer, but I wanted to highlight on the fact that you don't exist without your partners, and your partners are your strongest, one of the strongest assets if you know how to utilize them. And getting one of the best, in our opinion, it's like one of the best robotic solution in Germany to be our partner and long-term partner for almost 2 years now. That is number one, guarantees that we have the best product. Number two, guarantees that nobody has access to them.
Cool.
Probably our last question, but I don't promise that. What was your biggest challenge and learning throughout your whole so far career?
Yeah, I mean, I don't wanna breach. So, but I think one main thing is that literally anything you can do, or anything you want to do, you could do. And two is that there is not one route for your goal or for your objective to achieve. To give you like a quick example, when I wanted to switch from working as a researcher and move to business without knowing much about business, I applied for almost 500 companies to work in any business related role. And like, I didn't know much. So it's like key account management, yes, I'm going to apply. Sales engineer, yes, I'm going to apply. Sales manager, yes. And I just kept getting rejected. And I remember whenever I received a response for any application I sent, I was looking always for this word LIDAR convenience or LIDAR. Like, I'm just looking for this, like, unfortunately, we're not going to continue with your application.
Mm-hmm.
And I think looking back at this time and looking, like, kind of zooming out, my decision was that, well, in order for me to be able to break into the business world and business industry, I need to study. And so what I did is that I went to do my second master's in business.
Mm-hmm.
But looking back, like knowing now what I know today is that back then that was the only way that I thought I could do so that I can work in business. But knowing what I know today, I think that this is one of like 10 or 15 different ways I could do to get there. That today I'm doing like on the side, like a fun thing, which I'm doing a side thing called the fake company.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm doing fake brands. So not fake brands, but like fake activities.
Okay.
So like for the past year, I've been just like playing around to be a DJ. So I call myself the fake DJ. just because I'm not professional enough. And then within 1 year, I had like 35 different gigs in 2019. It's just like, I think it's a message that just says, well, if you want to be a DJ, you could be a DJ. If you want to be a yoga teacher, you can be a yoga teacher. Whatever you think this is something you want to do, there's really nothing could stop you.
Awesome. With that, I have one more question for you.
Is that
the last one? I'm not sure. It could be.
Can't promise.
If you could choose one person to go out for dinner with, it doesn't need to be alive, can be dead, years ago. Who would that one person be and why?
As cheesy as this sounds, but I think it would be Obama for one really not so obvious reason is that whenever I watched any of his speeches or like walk into the speech, especially, he had this ability that's like was insane. His ability to make you feel that he's with you.
Yeah.
So like the way he would like be walking the crowd and just like looking at every single person, just like waving at him, and maybe just like touching them and like on their shoulder, and like this sympathetic, I think yes, mm-hmm. sympathetic way of making everybody feel as important as they would like to feel. It always fascinates me, like his speeches and like his way of making people feel like they're part of whatever he's saying to learn from. Yeah.
Yeah.
also, I'd like to go to the US again. I'm sure he has some connections.
So with that, you said a lot of interesting things from horses replacing cars, from people being replaced by computers, ADMs. But you also mentioned what it means to be a great mentor, which I liked a lot, which is number one, humbleness. The internal belief that you can know better. And also, it's not about giving the advice, but asking the right questions so that you and the person that you're advising or that you're mentoring come to a conclusion together. You also mentioned the so-called octopus strategy, which pretty much means just to try to be everywhere and try to be everywhere where your potential customers and your leads are. And as cheesy as it may sound, anything you can do, you could do. It's very interesting that you said you could do that, you can do, because there's a lot of steps that you have to take in between. And this leads us to the last thing that you said very early in the beginning. There's a journey in growth, just like it is in life. And with these beautiful words, I would like to say thank you so much for your time. Your insights were there. It was such a pleasure speaking with you. We'll share everything about you underneath this episode, and we look very much forward to seeing what's going to happen with you and Copious in 2020.
I'm really looking forward.